And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Katie is coming from the Fifth Tradition Group. She's in our rooms often. I see her in a lot of meetings. And she's a Facebook pal and a very good one. And it's just a joy to know. And you'll get to know more about her. So welcome her. Give her a big round of applause.
Hey, everybody. I'm Katie Hillman. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to get the stats out of the way. I heard that the other day. I like that. My sobriety date is July the 12th, 2009. I have a sponsor. I have a home group. It's Fifth Tradition. And I sponsor four girls. I like that NABA has this on Monday night, because I think that this is how listening to people's stories is how you can relate. And you know, while I stand up here and I look different than some of you, I might be a girl and you're a guy or whatever, it's what the hopeless condition that we all, that I get, that I'll get to in my story, that hopefully you can relate to, and that maybe it'll give you some hope if you're struggling with this, because I do have relapse in my story, and I'll hit on that. So if there's anybody that's has that, they'll probably benefit from the story. You won't want to go where I've been, but or maybe you will, I don't know. But anyway, I am Katie, and I'm an alcoholic. And thanks to the NABA group and Tim for asking me to do this. All right, what it was like. I was born and raised around here, about 2 or 3 miles from here. I was born and went to grammar school and went to high school around here, Oak Grove and Lakeside. And I was also educated at the University of Georgia. So I'm totally an Atlanta native, which there's not that many of us around. And I still live within 2 miles of here. I just love this area. And grew up in what would look like a normal family. You know, I had two parents. My mom stayed home and took care of us and made our lunches and made 3 meals a day. And there was an older brother and an older sister. And it was fairly normal. I mean, we're in a good neighborhood and we were provided for and stuff like that. Later on, obviously my dad is an alcoholic, so it's not exactly normal. But, you know, you get used to whatever you have. And that's what I grew up with. You know, I thought it was normal, you know. And everywhere, and he drank every day after work, and, you know, thought it was okay because he, you know, went to work every day and provided for us. And that's kind of, we were kind of like the, you know, they were kind of like the Cleaver family or whatever in a way, you know, it was kind of like that. But, you know, there was a lot of arguing and stuff that went on behind closed doors, but we always worried, we put on a good look for what people saw on the outside. My sister set the, bar pretty high, because she or low, I guess I should say. She was like you know, the kind of kid that had a smoking permit and was into, you know, drugs and alcohol early. And so there was all, you know, she's 9 years older. So when I was in probably 7th grade, I remember my sister was arrested for walking around with angel dust on. She had a lettuce on her head, but she was on angel dust, and she had to go to a psych ward and here locally in Atlanta, and we had to visit her and stuff. And it was like, you know, all this happened because of drugs and alcohol, and you would think that it would be like, okay, to the little ones, you know, you might not want to do that. But we just thought, you know, we didn't think that at all. And then my brother was kind of shy and kind of quiet. And then I came along, and very, very competitive in all kinds of sports. I mean, I was like, you know, softball for 16 years and competitive swimming and diving and valley tap toe jazz and cheerleading. And, sports were just my escape. I mean, my mom ran me around constantly taking me to stuff. And I was kind of the good kid. I mean, let's see, my dad was in the Army, and my granddad was a colonel, so we were very disciplined. We were very much regimented, and everything was very rigid. We ate, I always say this, I don't know why I always tell this, but it's just funny because I didn't know any different, but we ate the same meal for breakfast every single day. For all I can remember, up like every Monday it was like Pop-Tarts, and Tuesdays it was like turnovers, and Wednesdays it was eggs, and Thursdays it was whatever. And we did that every single time. And Dad stood up and ate, And he said it was better that way, but I don't know why he made us sit down. But we, and there was a timer, and you had to finish it on time or you got a spanking. And I was always not finishing it on time, and I was always getting a spanking. And my brother was always like, you know, just eat it, you know, just eat it. You know, you're going to get a spanking. I was like, I don't like it. So we'd go through the whole thing, I get a spanking, and then off to school I would go. So, and, you know, it was all in love. I mean, I didn't think anything was weird about it. And I guess Mom was sleeping, which is why I know why I sleep all the morning now, because I don't think she was around then. But, you know, but it was a good childhood. I mean, it was, so after my, sister did that, my brother sort of always watched out after me. And he was like, you know, when you go to Lakeside, you need to do these certain things, you know, to be popular and to do this and that. And so, you know, he got, you know, I was a gymnast already. So he was like, you got to try out for cheerleading. So I did. And I just had kind of a real lucky, good life. I mean, Lakeside was great to me. I had a great high school. But I definitely started like living the double life they talk about. I mean, I was, you know, always hanging around all the popular girls all during the year. And then like Christmas holidays and summers, I had this other friend that's still my real good friend today, and we would always, you know, just do bad things. Like, we would sneak out of her house, we would steal cars, we would, like, not cars, but her family's car. We would take the car out and, you know, get drunk and get in trouble, and then I would act like, you know, I was a straight-A, you know, goody-two-shoes when I went back to high school or during the year. First, you know, drink, everybody just talks about the first one. I think I was in like seventh grade, and three or four of us went out, and we had a few, and we got in trouble. That wasn't really monumental to me. I mostly remember, you know, my cousins were a big part of our life. My mom's a twin, so my cousins were always coming in town, and they were 2 years older than me. So it was really like me and four older people, and they flew down from Chicago every year, and they brought with them marijuana. I guess you could bring it on the planes way back then. And we would always go to the end of Cravey Drive, which now is funny because, you know, I live near Cravey, and we would go to the end of the Cravey where it was a dead end. I see all these heads shaking. People must be from around here. And we would just like get drunk and stoned way back there, you know, in this small, you know, this deserted area. And I mean, I was probably eighth, ninth grade, but they were like, you know, I was so cool. They always let me hang out with them. And so kind of grew up fast. I used to always say I grew up fast, but I was generally pretty good. I mean, I got drunk a few times in high school, and I'm sure I got wasted in Panama City on spring break. But the problem started when I went to the University of Georgia. I started drinking really heavily. I joined a sorority and tried to continue to do all the right things, but I was getting messed up with the different kind of crowds, and I was, you know, I started doing drugs, and I started, you know, drinking a lot. And so, you know, basically I would do all the things that, you know, I had said I wouldn't do, and then I would wake up the next day and be like, well, if no one knows, it really didn't happen, and it was quite fun anyway, and, you know, let's do this, you know, all over again. And I did that for a while, and I ended up getting my first DUI at the University of Georgia on campus. I was in a car riding around, and I was with a bunch of my friends, the same one that I hung out in high school, and we had tripped the night before, and so we were still tripping, and, you know, the stuff never goes away. I mean, it's like 24 hours, and you're still like, you know, and so so I was drinking, and I was doing that, and I ended up saying, you know, well, I didn't have a car because my brother and sister had wrecked so many cars. My parents wouldn't let me have a car, but I still managed to get a DUI driving somebody else's car, so I was like, let me drive. And so I drove the car, and I got pulled over, and I told everybody, you know, I've heard this thing that if, you know, if you take the keys out and you switch, you know, you all switch seats and you say that you weren't driving, you know, nobody will get a DUI. And so the cop came up and they said, who's driving? And they all said her. And I was like, y'all are not very good friends. So I went down the station and, you know, I got arrested. And I remember I thought my name was up there three times. And the guy was like, no, your name's only up there once. And then I remembered I was tripping. And it was, you know, it was crazy stuff was happening. The night before when I was tripping, I was riding a skateboard. I told you I was a huge tomboy. I can do like 180s and 360s and all that. And I lived on this hill, and I came down my hill, and I think I saw a car coming, but I really wasn't a car. It probably was a bug or something. You know how it is. Or it was a bug, and I thought it was a car. So I tried to do a 180, and I would fly across the driveway, and I had this chin that was like bruised and over to the side. So the cop was, you know, I was not pretty at all. And the cop was like, you know, what, you know, asked me if I was getting beaten. And I was like, no, you know, I did this on the skateboard. And so anyway, here I was in my mugshot. I had this long bruised chin to the side, and that was DUI number one. And I get out, and no, you know, again, don't tell anybody, and I get out of this myself. You know, I was always in this independent streak. I'll take care of this myself. So I decided to go to work for a topless bar. But I wasn't going to be bad because I wasn't topless. I was going to be the waitress who walked around in very little clothing, but I had a top on. And it was on Atlanta Highway. It was some redneck cowboy bar on the right. And none of my sorority friends would have gone in there, so I kept that secret. And I got $330 in ones basically working there, and then I quit. And then I went down to the judge, and I went down to court, and I told him I was indigent and that I had no family and that, they were lying. I wasn't driving, and the judge said, "You're guilty." And I was like, "You know, how do you know? You didn't even ask the court." And he was like, "I am the court." He's like, $330, and he slammed down the thing. And I remember I had this Crown Royal bag, and I had all the ones in there, and I threw it up there. And everybody was like, "Oh, God." And I can't believe I didn't get in more trouble than that, but they just let me go. They thought, I told them my parents died and all this other stuff. And, so that was like DUI number one. And then I kept, drinking. And one of the first major, there was lots of consequences, but a material consequence, I guess you would say, is I had been in all kinds of trouble at Georgia. I was got caught cheating and talked my way out of that. And I actually got caught cheating on the SAT, but that's already passed out in the story, so we won't go back there. But I was cheating, and I ended up leaving the University of Georgia to move in with my drug dealer, and I had one class left, and I've never gone back to finish, which obviously was not a great thing for my folks who spent a lot of money on putting me through college for 5 years, and I still didn't graduate. But I left, and I thought, this is going to be great. You know, I don't have to buy my drugs anymore. I can just sleep with them and get my drugs. So I did that for a while, and I was waitressing, and there's nothing wrong with waitressing, but I was losing jobs and getting jobs and losing jobs and getting jobs, and then, you know, working during the day and going out all night and waking up and some nights at Backstreet and all that stuff, you know, up all night long and going straight into La Peep restaurant working, smelling horrible, eyes like staring at them like, you know, I looked like the one runaway bride. I mean, I was just like horrible. I did this over and over and over again. And, you know, nothing seemed to change. And, you know, I love what one of my sponsor actually said this. She says, you know, it tells well, but it doesn't live very pretty. And it didn't. There was so many things. I mean, like, you know, I remember one time, there's just so many stories I could tell. It's crazy. But a couple that come to mind was I was waitressing at La Peep, and I was in the middle of taking an order. And I remembered that I left all my little, I was, you know, distributing a little bit at that point. And I remember I'd left all of them in my spare apron that was at the house. And my mother came home on Wednesdays to clean the house because she lived in Macon, taking care of my mom, her parents. And I was living in the house with my cousin Wes, and I'm in the middle of taking an order. And I'm like, holy cow. And it wasn't that she was going to catch what was in the apron. It was that it was going to be washed and I was going to lose it. And I literally ran out of La Peep and rushed home and grabbed the apron just in time and didn't say what it was for to my mom. And it was like, I just remember going, thank God my drugs didn't get washed down. And, and it was just like, and there were instances where, you know, like I was living with Wes and he loves this one. He said that I was passed out one night and I came out wandering through this apartment that we could barely make rent on naked, and it was not a pretty sight. And I tried to pee on the cat box. And, it seemed quite normal. I mean, those are just the humiliating things we do. But, you know, I guess when you're in a drunken stupor, it seemed like a great place. Hey, cats think it is. I mean, evidently, you know, in my drunken stupor, he was just like, oh, my God, you're so disgusting. Get out of here. And the next day, he told me. And, I mean, there were just, like, numerous things like that. There were the wake up and, oh, my God, who are you with? And, oh, God, get me out of here. And, you know, look at peering out, saying, please, car, be out there. And I remember thought my car was stolen once, called and reported it. And then as the day went on, I remembered that I was at several bars, and I went looking, and I found it. So those are just some of the things that I'm sure we've all done, you know, that we can relate to, you know, something similar. I don't know if any of y'all have, like, gone to the cat box, but, you know, it's just crazy stuff. In 1995, I got sober for the first time, and I stayed sober for 8 years, which is until 2003. And before 1995, when I picked up that white chip, which I stayed sober the whole 8 years, I racked up DUI number 2 and 3. I was running everybody out of my life. It was not being fun anymore. I was pretty much having to, get sober for a few, days to get people off my back, and I was just, drinking all the time, and Let's see. I got a DUI. I played softball at the country club. I played on five teams at the softball country club at one time because that's how we do things, you know. And so I'm on, like, all these teams, and anyway, we win, and I get drunk, and we're going to back streets because I got to finish the party more, and I get arrested, and the girl in the car gets out, runs with her backpack. I mean, there should have been some sort of a theme here. I should have realized that my friends were going to desert me. And but they did, and I got arrested for DUI number two. And then it was 20 days later, that was November 4th, 1992, and it was 20, which was when President Clinton was inaugurated, and it was 20 days later on Thanksgiving Eve that I was out yet once again on Cheshire Bridge Road driving down the road and got pulled over again, and I swore that I only had, it was like quarter beer night, and only brought like $2. So it was like, you know, I'm not going to get drunk, you know. I understand, you know, I'd got a job at Circuit City to be on top of my Fast Signs job, on top of my LaPeep job to pay for the DUI, and, you know, I was managing, you know, if only I could manage well, like they say. And so, and, you know, I ended up going, you know, driving down, I get pulled over, and I was only like 0.10 or 1.0 or whatever it is. So not drunk for me at all. And he gives me a DUI anyway, and I was so belligerent. I was screaming at him and telling him he was a loser and, you know, just all this stuff. It was horrible. And, you know, I tried to do gymnastics to get out of it, and, you know, that didn't work no matter what I did. I was like, you know, I can do a backflip on this line and stick it. And he didn't want any of it. He just said, you know, he took me out of Georgia Tech for some reason, and I refused to breathalyzer, so they did a blood test, and anyway, it was DUI number three, and so I ended up going to court, and I remember they were suspending my license, and I drove right out of there, you know, DeKalb County, you know, thanks, Judge, great, you know, just drove right out of there, suspending my license, you know, rules did not apply. I was a huge narcissist, and I was like, you know, I'll show you, I'll whatever, and I hired this lawyer who is a friend of the family's, and they tried me for both of them on the same day, and I ended up going to, like, a women's prison for 10 days. I love saying that, women's prison, it sounds so good, and, you know, and of course in there I wanted to change the rules. I mean, I was like, you know, these are not nice circumstances for women to be, you know, being, you know, under, you know, having to stay in. You know, there was like rats and water was dripping and all this stuff, and I was going to write to the Atlanta Journal. I mean, you know, I needed to fix this. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm in there, you know, on my third DUI, and I have a drinking problem, but none of that seemed to click at all. And, you know, I made that fun. I tend to try to make things, whatever I'm doing, very fun. I mean, I organized a dance contest in there, and we had an absolute blast. I mean, we did. We had, I was like, this girl came in, and I knew her from the streets, and she had a headphones. She was doing weekends, so I said, you know, we got headphones. I was like, you and me and another girl will be the judges, and all these quiet, shy people that don't talk, y'all, and pregnant, y'all are the audience, and there were so many crack addicts in there, it wasn't even funny. Crack addicts were the dancers, and so they, everybody loved it. They were like, this is great, you know. We had the best time. By then, I was kind of liked, and I was well known. I was like, you know, I'm a street girl, you know, and I was like, God, I'm scared to death. And so we had different outfits that they had, and it was so hilarious, y'all. We all laughed so much because the only person that could hear the music was the dancer, and it was so hilarious, you know. You could hear a little bit, but not much. And then, you know, some of those girls were coming out with it pulled up real high and doing like the pole dancing because they probably were experienced strippers. We had a blast. I mean, they all didn't want me to leave, and I was trying to save them all. I was like, you know, come out, here's my number, and got out of there. Nothing changed. I had, you know, had met my, you know, list of requirements. You know, you have to go to DUI school, and you have to go to jail, and you have to do this stuff. Check, check, check. And didn't dawn on me that I needed to quit drinking. And I went on for, that's 2 and 3 DUIs were 92, and I quit drinking until 95. And it just got horrible. I mean, every relationship I was in, they were like, oh, my God, please, lose my number. And, you know, don't call. And so I eventually, by this time, my sister and brother were in AA, and my mom was divorcing my dad because he was just a total alcoholic. You know, my mom said basically, you know, it's near the bottle, and it was like instant. It was the bottle. I mean, it was not even a thought. And so they were splitting up, and, you know, and or maybe they already had. I can't really remember. But I knew about AA, and so I was like, you know, I'll go to AA and do that, but, you know, you're going to miss me and all this stuff. And they were like, no. So I went into AA, and I got in, you know, kind of head first. And I did the fellowship. I did the fellowship. I did the first step. I did not drink, and I knew my life was unmanageable. It was very clear to me because when you remove the alcohol and drugs from me, I was a lot better person. I mean, I no longer humiliated you. I no longer told you, you know, that you were fat, even if you were. I didn't say you were ugly, even if you were. I mean, you know, I was I thought that I was entitled to say that, and I was sick. I was untreated. I was mean. I would just, you know, I was a horrible person to be around. And so when you remove drugs and alcohol, people started liking me. And they were like, you know, oh, you're getting so much better. And so I did fellowship, and I did First Step. I didn't do really anything else. I mean, I had those sponsors and names, and, oh, yeah, so-and-so is my sponsor, and so-and-so. And then my life got better. I mean, it does. I mean, you know, I started getting into my career. I'm very competitive. I got a sales job, and I started to, you know, I wanted to be the best at that. And without drinking, I could get to work on time. I could work late because, you know, drinking and drugging were my number one thing. And when I got this job, it was not like that. I got really, really good, and that became a big motivator for me to be number one in sales, and which I was for all of those 8 years. And you know, because of that, doesn't matter if you have an education in sales. My major was nutrition, and I was selling signs. So, you know, they weren't related. And so, you know, because of the job success, I was able to get the material things. You know, I started getting the houses and the cars and the whatever, you know, all the stuff. And after, let's see, my sobriety date was 4/22/95, and exactly 8 years later, on the nose almost, I was out with some people, some architects that I work with, and you know, I had stopped going to meetings. I remember the time in my life, I was like, I'll never drink again. I was signing these jails, and I was like, thank God I'll never be in jail again, because I was doing signs on the jail. Little did I know, DUI number 4 was coming up. And I, you know, I had that attitude, you know, I'm better than that. I'm not going to end up here. And I started thinking, you know, those AA meetings are for those people who, you know, they have to have them, you know. And I was going to one a week, and everybody in my life was, we all started kind of separate. The fellowship wasn't there for me so much. And so I was kind of doing it on my own. And I ended up drinking, and I got, the first time I drank, I went home, and my roommate didn't notice. My cousin didn't notice. And I thought, wow, you know, I was only 27 when I quit. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic after all. You know, I'm 35, you know, 27. Come on. Who's an alcoholic at 27? I was like, so I drank second time. Nobody noticed. And I thought, wow, you know, God, all that silly stuff. So anyway, next thing you know, by the third or fourth time, I mean, I was totally, you know, passing out. I was doing horrible stuff. I was back to the same place I was. And I don't know how I managed to do this, but I managed to get a boyfriend who I told him not to tell the family that I was drinking because they were all alcoholics and they didn't like talk about alcohol. And I told the family I didn't want the boyfriend to know I was an alcoholic because, you know, I wasn't drinking anymore and it wasn't something he needed to know anyway. And they were just so glad I was dating him and so glad I was pulling it together. And I had someone to watch me that they obeyed by those rules. And so 12 months or 14 months, I managed this. And I mean, going to like Spain with this guy, being lost in a cathedral square and drinking all the bottles in the hotel room. And oh God, he saved me from DUI number 5. I ended up, so anyway, my life became a wreck. I was going through boyfriend after boyfriend after boyfriend. And I was coming in here, and I remember thinking, oh my God, everybody at NABA thinks, you know, you can't get it. Like, y'all were really thinking that. Y'all were probably just thinking about yourself. I mean, if you're anything like me, you weren't thinking about me, and you certainly were hoping for the best. You weren't hoping for me to continue to come through that door. But, you know, that's the stuff that was in my head, and I was just like, you know, and I was going to all these, I was mixing it up. I mean, Triangle, Biscayne, NABA, you know, maybe they won't, you know, they'll think I've been sober for a while. And people would say, you know, you're all right and all this stuff. And I was like 6 years I was out there doing this. It got horrible. And like I said, I got DUI number 4. And that one, I ended up losing my license. And that was a little hard to manage. I was still managing. I wasn't letting God run my life at all. I was running it. I got a driver for my appointments on Monday. And you know, I got cabs or I got somebody to take me to work, and I paid them. And just still, like, didn't let anybody at work know. Keeping that, you know, that separate life. You know, work does not need to know I'm taking, you know, checker cab to work. And, you know, checker cab doesn't need to know that I'm doing cocaine in the back seat. And, you know, work does not need to know that I left some there for Monday morning. I mean, it was all this stuff. You know, it was like, you know, how am I going to get in? The only time I ever did drugs, because I'm an alcoholic through and through, was to, because people were always looking for the symptoms of alcohol on me. And it was like, you know, I would have to go somewhere where I couldn't drink. And, you know, and so, you know, a lot of stuff bad happened. A lot of bad happened. I ended up going to a treatment center for 4 months, which I'd never done. I went to Peachford a couple of times. And, you know, everybody was just saying, you know, she's going to take losing her job, or, you know, I don't think she's going to get it. Or I heard a lot of the, she's constitutionally incapable. Or at least I thought that. I was probably hallucinating. I mean, I was drinking so much. It was ridiculous. I'd gotten to the point where I was several nights, I mean, not every night, but most nights I would, you know, tell myself in the morning, you know, I'm not going to drink tonight, and I'm just going to get, you know, whatever. And I remember stopping off at the liquor store and getting those little ones or whatever, and then walking a couple steps out and going back in and going, you got a cup of ice? And they were like, you know, that stopped being legal. And then, you know, what do you mean it stopped being legal? When did that happen, you know? Why can't I get a cup of ice? I'm using it for water, arguing with the liquor store guy. And finally just getting in my car and, you know, twisting them off and drinking it plain or whatever before I got home, because I couldn't even wait till I got home to get whatever I had in the freezer or the shower or wherever I had it. I mean, I was hiding the stuff, and I lived alone. I mean, no one wanted to be with me. I was hiding it. I'd be like, where did I put it? And I'd check all my hiding places, and I'd go in and see if anybody was there, and I'd, you know, change the code on the alarm so my brother couldn't get in, and it was just insane, you know, and people trying to help me, and I just wasn't ready, and I wasn't done, and you have to be done. And so I ended up, some more humiliating things happened, like one of the funny stories that's just so ridiculous, but I ended up dating my neighbor two doors down, and he, and there's a guy in here tonight, which I don't even know why he's here, because he's heard my story so many times, but he was in treatment with me at the four-month place. And, you know, when you're in treatment, and then I'll get to sobriety, but when you're in treatment, they a lot of treatment centers make the family and friends write these things called impact letters. And it's these letters that tell the group how you impacted their life in a horrible way. You know, like, you know, she hurt me, or she cheated on me, or she, you know, flipped out at a family reunion on my mother, and it was devastating. So that was in her letter, for example. So apparently, this guy, you know, I guess after I was dating him or whatever, I was home drinking during the day. I missed like 35 days of work, by the way, when I was drinking. I was always calling in. I said my lawn was on fire. I mean, I had so much stuff. I made up so many lies. My boss cracks up at all this stuff I did. And so, but anyway, like 2 o'clock one afternoon, evidently, I thought it was a good idea to go get the mail, and all I had on was my Prada sunglasses because I was styling in some heels. And this felt like a 100-foot walk. And that's not a pretty sight at all. I was so drunk, I probably had my cocktail, you know. And he was like, dude, you know. And he had his son with him. It was not good at all. And so you know, those were some of the things. And that got read at the group wherever Alan is in here. He heard it. And it was pretty humiliating because you forget about all the stuff you do. You're kind of like, you know, like as if you're drunk, it's okay. And so you know, so let's see. So I floundered around a long time trying to get sober. And finally, you know, I'd got to a point where I kept coming back to the, you know, to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew it was the only answer. I knew it was a solution. It had worked for my sister and brother. It had worked for my dad for some time till he stopped doing what's suggested. So I came back in, and that was, like I said, about 3 years ago. And I had seen a girl at like the last four times I'd been to a meeting, I'd seen this girl. And so I was with a treatment friend of mine, and she said, why don't you ask that girl to sponsor you? And I was kind of like, I want to do this, but I don't want to do all that now. I don't know that I want to go up and ask somebody to sponsor me, you know. And she nudged me, and it took that little nudge, and so I did. And she's still my sponsor today, and it's been really good. She's been really helpful, and I encourage anybody that hasn't done it. I mean, it's not a stupid, corny thing. It's actually a really good thing, because it's somebody that gets to know you and hears all the stuff that's happened and can relate it back to certain things that you've done in the past and say, you know, and help you through stuff. And I used to think you only call your sponsor when you want to drink. And that's, you know, and so I was like, well, once I'm over the 3 days of having convulsions or detoxing or whatever, I won't need her anymore. Again, I can do this on my own. And I was taught through all the women in my group, you know, that no, you know, you call them when you're about to make a major decision in your life or before you do something foolish or when you are, you know, using, you know, when your alcoholic thinking, you know, kicks in and you think, maybe this is a good idea. And so anyway, I got a sponsor, and the first thing she suggested was you need to join a home group. And I'm like, oh God, I was, you know. And so I said, where do you go? And she told me, and said, it's a new group, try it. So I did. And just like most of us, I felt like I didn't fit in when I first went in and had all these reasons why they were different. But I ended up going again and again, and I joined it. And then I started feeling like I fit in, and I started participating and being a part of, and life got a lot better for me, a lot more rich. You know, I felt a lot more peace, and I started, I wanted what those girls had that were in the center, that were connected, and they were doing extra stuff. And so being competitive, I was like, I can do the extra stuff. So I started signing up. I was like, I'll bring the meetings to the jail. And, you know, you want me to, you know, whatever it was that she suggested I do, you know, I did, you know, go to every home group meeting. You know, she said, unless you're, you know, I think it was you're in the hospital or you're bleeding, you need to come to a home group. I was like, dear God, that's a little, you know, harsh, but all right, you know, and I did. And then, and I went until I wanted to. Now I'm excited about them. I mean, now it's like, if you get a new outfit, you wear it to an AA meeting. I mean, where else are you going to go? You know, I mean, you know, I don't wear it to work. And then, you know, and then, you know, so I went in there and I started doing what they did, and I met some of the best girls. You know, we have a good time, but it's like wherever you feel comfortable, wherever home group you join, you know, it should be somewhere where, you know, you can get to it, you can get connected, and you can, you know, get the message, and you can hear what they're saying, because the suggestions are the same thing over and over, and I wasn't doing them before. And so, we worked the steps, you know, I went, you know, I don't know if that I can go through all the steps, but, cause I'm not that good at that. But, you know, I knew one and two before I, you know, came in here. I mean, I obviously was, there was loads of reasons and experiences that I knew I was powerless, and I knew my life was unmanageable. I mean, I kept trying to manage it, yet I kept ending up in the same place, promising myself I wouldn't drink again and being hopeless at the evening of, you know, oh well, I'll just stop and have one. And one, it was never one. I was always getting loaded. And then I never knew what would happen. And then I, you know, and you know, I believed in a higher power, and I was, you know, taught that, you know, you just gotta believe that, you know, there's a power greater than you can destroy. You just send the words, you need to, you know, tap into that and ask for help. So I did that, and willing to do the fourth step. I got instructions, so I like that. I like columns, and I like Excel sheets. I like columns. I want to, you know, put the stuff in sheets, and that way, that was good. I felt like I completed it, and I told her everything, and there was something I held back, and then I said, you know, I'm just going to say it, and there was no big deal. And 6 and 7, you know, what happened for me there was, I actually, in my group, there's a couple of really good, I guess, AAers, and they were having a meeting at their house doing a workshop on 6 and 7, like Drop the Rock. And I had just met the love of my life in my home group, and he was so cute. And he asked me if I was going to, his sponsor was having it, and he's like, you know, do you know the Bells? And I'm like, yeah, I know Carrie. And he's like, you want to come to this, you know, thing over there? I was like, yeah, you know. And I mean, I swear, I was interested in the guy. I really didn't know what the hell the Drop the Rock was, but I went, and I got a lot out of it, because I was like, you know, I want to, you know, I mean, I think we'd gone out for a week, maybe two, when he asked me to do this thing, and that engaged me in another small, intimate group of 9 people, and it happened to be some of these really stronger members that were also men in our group that were talking honestly about what was going on, and what character defects they had, and what they did to solve them, and how they looked like in their life. And I was like, golly, you know, this is, and then I, you know, I got close to another friend in there that was going there, that was also in our home group, and it just was a really good thing. I think it went on for, we ended up doing a couple other books, and that got me connected, you know, and I was willing to do it, even though it wasn't suggested by my sponsor. It was, well, I mean, there wasn't attraction, but I mean, and, you know, anyway, I did it. So, and then, you know, I made a list, and I, you know, made my amends, and, you know, and then I did 10 and 11. I started, you know, looking at my day and looking at where I'd been selfish and self-centered and all that stuff. And I, oh my God, it was like everywhere. I mean, I couldn't answer every one of those questions. I was like, okay, did that. And, you know, finally, when I started seeing the same reoccurring person come up and my behavior, you know, being the same that it became objectionable to me, the behavior I was having. So my sponsor was like, why don't you do a, you know, a fear inventory on that, or a, you know, a mini fifth step on that. I was like, God, what, I mentioned it. But so I did, and I got through that. And I mean, major things I'm humbled these days. I used to be so conceited, and I'm much more humble now. And so I will tell you that, you know, I had worked my way up at this company, and I was a sales manager. And during my relapses, a couple of them, I fell on the floor drunk at 9:30 in the morning. And they had to take me to once they took me to the hospital, and the other two times they called boyfriend number 2 and 3. And see, I didn't last long. So they came in along with the folks, and anyway, then my point is that I was no longer, I was demoted from a sales manager to just a salesperson. And of course, I was like, oh, that's good. That's all I ever wanted to be. Until they then told me that one of the people I hired was going to be my boss. And I was like, whoa. And that took a lot of work in this program because, I mean, I was like, he wouldn't even be here if I didn't hire him. And everything he knows, I taught him, which was so not true. I mean, this guy was much more construction-minded. He really didn't teach him that much. But if you would have seen me prior to I got sobriety, it would have been all me. And this company owes me and all this stuff. And, you know, I worked through it, and now we're friends now, and I really am fine with it. In fact, it's amazing how when you work this stuff through it and talk to people about it, because I talk a lot, which has actually been good, because I tell my friends, I tell my sponsor, I tell my husband, and you get enough of the same answer, you're like, okay, I might need to do this. You know what I mean? Because, you know, I go to each one hoping I get a different answer, and then I don't have to do it. Same manipulative behavior I used to do when I was out there. And but in the program, you get the same stuff. It's not rocket science. It's like, well, have you prayed about it? You know, might want to do an inventory on it. Who have you called and asked how they're doing today? And I'm like, no one. That's something. And that, you know, I had to work through in sobriety. Like I said, when I came to this home group, today the way it looks is I never miss a home group meeting unless there is absolutely a major reason to miss it. And that is because, not because someone said to do it now, it's because I want to be there. I want to be accountable. I want to be part of. I want to know what's going on. I mean, sure, part of it's I want to see my friends and I want to see what so-and-so's wearing. Are they wearing their shoes again? I'm not perfect. It's progress, you know. But I do. I love going there. And I love, you know, being a member of this group. I love what it stands for. You know, member of this Alcoholics Anonymous in general. And, you know, I pray. I work with girls, and I'm telling you, it wasn't even a year ago. I was like, I don't want to be those people that have to give my time to other people. You know, I'll do all the other stuff, but I'm not keen on sponsoring all these girls now. And, you know, God had a different plan for me, and He's brought some wonderful people in my life, and, you know, that's really kept me away from the stuff that's been, you know, that could drive you, you know, to getting between your ears, which is where our disease centers, you know. I mean, I had, I think worth mentioning is, on April 24th of this year, my brother died suddenly of a heart attack, and it was, you know, pretty devastating. And he was only 50, and he was a member of this fellowship. And but it was like so much easier because people just surrounded me with love, and they were there for me, and so many calls. And I knew that it wasn't about me, and it wasn't how's this going to affect me. And I knew to be strong and ask for help and help my mom through it and stuff like that. I mean, much harder for mom and dad than it is for me. And been able to, you know, deal with helping my dad. I mean, I've people now in my life, particularly one person I can think of that has having to take care of their parents. And I'm telling you, I had a big resentment around that when I started doing it 7 years ago. I mean, I got my fourth DUI the day after, you know, my dad was on life support, and he keeps getting better and better and better, and I've continued to take care of him all the way to, it's gone from taking care of him for his daily needs to financial. And it's been hard, you know. It's, you know, you have to do a lot of talking about that and praying about it and realizing that, you know, it's not me that's helping him. It's like God gave me this job to be able to help him, not me. And, you know, and I'm grateful to be able to help him now. Now I love going to see him, but that was also brought to my attention when, you know, my husband came in my life and he was wanting to go see him, and it wasn't like dreadful anymore. It wasn't a labor of love. I used to call it, you know, this is my kid I never wanted to have. Now I'm like, I love my dad. And it just, it takes going through all the stuff that you go through to get to that place. Also, I had a sponsee die, maybe almost 6 or 7 weeks ago, and that was very tough. Member of our home group, member of this fellowship, and that was very hard. I mean, you know, it was very clear to me. It was, you know, nothing I did, not about me, but it was still sad. I mean, I loved her, and you know, I like to look at it that she died of, you know, this disease, and that in the hopes that maybe it can help somebody else. That this is serious life and death stuff. I mean, I know if I go back out again, there's no doubt about it that I'll drink and drive and either kill myself or kill somebody else. And either one of those are objectionable. especially killing somebody else. And you know, also because that's horrible to take someone's life, but I don't want to spend the rest of my life in jail. And I don't have to. I have a good life. I have a solution. I have this program. I have all the people in my life that's really, really good. But I was the girl that always drank again. I mean, trust me. If you were there during my 6 years of going out of these rooms, I mean, you would just be like, I mean, I had alcoholic comas. There was so much crap, and you just don't even want to go into it. But it was just like, I don't look like that person that did that. But if you could only ask my mother how many awful times she had to, you know, come get me out of the hospital, or I was taken away in the ambulances, or my work, or the God, the boyfriends, dear God, bless their soul. I mean, they peed in the bed and all kinds of stuff. It was not pretty. And today is a different life. And like I said, I met my love of my life here in this program, and we got married, and we actually, it's funny because right before this meeting, somebody asked me, they're like, you got married? Did you wait the year? And I'm like, no, it's not in the book. You know, I go by the book now, especially when it's in my favor. I didn't wait the year, but I did run it by my sponsor, and I did have those 8 years prior to it, and I think I had 8 months or something. But I mean, he had four. But we didn't get married at 8 and 4. Or did we? I don't know. I can't remember. We started dating, I think, at 8 and 4. But, I mean, you know, we're still together, and we continue to work a program together, and we try to work traditions from this fellowship and our married life. And he has a sponsor, I have a sponsor, and, you know, we try our hardest not to be codependent on each other. And we try to, you know, work our own individual programs, and he's been nothing but a joy in my life. And, like I said, pretty amazing story I'll end with. When I was at the funeral for Loretta, many of y'all might know Loretta, just a beautiful spirit, bright spot in my life, and in many people's. When I was at the after service, after the funeral, her family just made me feel so good and helpful in her life, even though I wasn't sure I felt that. But her brother introduced me to this other girl and said, you know, this other girl is dying inside. She's sober, but she's not working the steps. And she's just dying inside. I really wish you could hook up with her and meet her. And maybe, you know, you could make a difference in her life, or she could help. Not thinking that she could help me. And I'm like, sure, introduce me. So she introduced me. And all I said was, why don't you come to a meeting tonight? I'll meet you at a meeting tonight. I'll be on the front row. And so she came. And we started talking. And as we talked more and more, okay, this is not only... her sister was married to Loretta's brother, so that was that connection. So here it is, a sponsor of mine that is just lost, you know, basically taken her life, and this is her. Kay is my new sponsee. You know, her sister was married to Loretta's brother, and that's who introduced us. Well, we start talking, and somehow my brother comes up, and she's like, "What's his name?" I told him. She's like, "Oh my God!" She's like, "That was your brother?" She's like, "I totally knew your brother." She's like, "We were friends for 3 years." She's like, "Does your mom live on such and such street? Do you live in this little white house with this little white dog?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And it was like the strangest thing. She flips open her phone. She's got my brother's phone number, and she knew and loved Alan, and it's so amazing. And if that's not God, I don't know what is. That's absolutely amazing. And so, you know, I know Loretta and Alan are probably looking down on this going, yep. And so it's really a remarkable thing. And she's jumped right in this time. She's already gotten a sponsee, and she's joined a home group, and she's working the steps, and she's reading the book. And so I feel like I made a difference in her life. And that's why we stand up here and tell all this terrible stuff about ourselves. It's so that, you know, you don't think anything you've done is irreparable or whatever, or incomprehensible. I'm trying to use these words. I have no idea what they mean. So, yeah. Shouldn't have cheated so much. God, who gets caught cheating on the SAT? You know how they caught me? I made a perfect score on the wrong test. I was a great cheater. I mean, I got all the right answers down. I copied it perfectly. It was just the wrong test. So, but those are the kind of things. And now I live my life differently. I try to be honest. And I, you know, I prayed before this and asked for help to try to reach somebody. So, you know, today my life is filled with, you know, it's things happen. You know, I started a new job, and that's been, you know, I've been at the company for 20 years, and it kind of like went under, and another one started, and I got to go there, which is a huge blessing, and I'm loving it. And I was so fearful about it, so fearful, because I was looking at how is it going to affect me, you know? I mean, oh my God, you know, what if I'm not the best, and what if I don't make all this money and all this stuff? And, you know, it's just not all about that, and I don't have that fear about it anymore. I mean, somehow, I think my husband said this once, you know, if the God takes care of the birds outside, I mean, I think he'll take care of me, you know. It's like, I'm not out there taking care of the birds and making sure they get food, you know. Somebody else much bigger than me is, and I like to look at it like that. And with this program, I think I can take anything that's thrown at me, almost. So I was halfway kidding because I'll end with something funny. I let my insurance lapse, and I've never let my insurance lapse for 20 years, and my husband rides a motorcycle. So I've been living in fear, and now I'm doing a step thing on it because I am like, just my luck. I've had insurance for 20 years, and, you know, something, God forbid, happens the next 2 weeks before my insurance kicks in on that motorcycle. So, I mean, I still have fear. I still have it. It comes to us, and we have to talk about it. We have to talk to others about it. And, you know, I wish I could say, don't ride that motorcycle, but, you know, listen to me. And I have to be okay with that. So, but today I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope I've said something that you guys can get something out of. And thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Katie. That was the fastest 3 hours of information I was ever engaged in. Amazing. Absolutely.
Well, my head was in tomorrow, and my feet followed history. I had an insane notion I could hoodoo everything around me. No. 'Cause too much of everything ain't enough for nothing to me. Put the plug in the jug. Man, I feel like I've been set free. For too much of everything ain't enough for nothing to me. Bye.